Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center, or EPIC. And I'm joined by my co-host and friend, Scott Greeson of Friends of the Eel River. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Doing okay.
And so, Scott, we're talking about summer steelhead and spring chinook today, and you have assembled a fine panel of guests for us to talk about the subject. So I will turn it over to you to introduce our guests.
Thanks, Tom. Joining us today in our virtual studio, which is to say on the internet where we all live now, are three distinguished guests. First, we got Bill Tripp with us from the Karuk tribe. Welcome, Bill.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And then we've got Craig Tucker, who's also been working with the Karuk tribe for years now, especially on the Klamath Dam removal project. Welcome, Craig.
Thanks for having me.
And last but far from least, Sam Canry. Sam's a lot of things, but our resident expert on summer steelhead. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I want to start off by having each of you tell everybody a little bit about who you are, what you do. But first, I want to tell everybody what we're talking about this week, which is these really amazing fish, summer steelhead and spring chinook. And the reason we talk about them together is that scientists have come to understand that both these fish are examples of premature migrating fish that have a lot in common, both in terms of how they interact with rivers and people, and also how we're going to protect them. So there are spring chinook in the Klamath that Bill and Craig have been working on, and summer steelhead in the Eel that Sam and I have been working on. So we have these two sets of stories we want to bring together and talk about. So Bill, why don't you start by just telling folks a little bit about the work you do with the Karuk tribe and, you know, a little bit about spring chinook and why they matter.
Well, yeah, today's my first day as the Director of Natural Resources and Environmental Policy with the Karuk tribe's Department of Natural Resources. And so I've been working for the past 27 years around this question, you know, starting in 1993 as a water resources technician with the Department of Natural Resources and doing a little bit of hatchery work before that, along with youth work, reconstructing our sacred salmon ceremony sweat house at McKee Autumn. And so, you know, I've dedicated my whole life to making the connections between fire and fish and basically working to fix the world here in our Aboriginal homelands.
Beautiful. Craig, what about you? Tell us a little bit about spring chinook and what you've been doing to try to get some protection for them.
Well, I've had the privilege for working for Bill and the Karuk tribe for almost two decades now. It's really been impressed upon me how vitally important spring chinook is, both culturally for the tribe and as a food source. And so we've done a lot of work trying to do things like remove dams, restore habitat, and I guess most recently we actually petitioned to have Klamath River spring chinook added to the endangered species list. So the agencies would have to, one, identify spring chinook as different than their fall run cousins and develop a plan to actually recover these fish before we lose them.
Okay, Sam, tell us a little bit about your work and summer steelhead, especially in the Eel and, well, more broadly in Northern California.
Yeah, I've been doing dive surveys monitoring summer steelhead in the Eel since about 2010, mostly in the Middle Fork, and then we started doing additional surveys in Van Dusen. And just really enjoy swimming with those fish throughout the summertime. And about 3-4 years ago, I started doing additional research into the distribution of summer and winter run steelhead throughout the Eel for a master's project at UC Davis. Completed that this past last summer and continuing the research with Native Fish Society and Friends of the Eel and kind of expanding that into throughout the rest of the Northern California distinct population segment and into the Klamath Mountain Province segment in a number of different basins to look at distribution, summer steelhead distribution around barriers and just to even see if we can find them in some of the additional basins. And they're pretty rare at this point and, you know, some populations are being actively monitored and have a good estimate of population size, but even ones that do have really low numbers and they're definitely at risk of extirpation on a basin by basin.
So here's probably a pretty obvious question for our guests. You know, I've obviously heard of chinook and steelhead. Are the summer and spring runs, are they of the same species? Why are we distinguishing them from, you know, other runs of these salmon? Are they genetically distinct? Are there some special markers in them that separate them?
I think there's a couple of different ways to think about this. But first off, there's how do they look? How do they behave? And Bill, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how the fish look in the river. How do spring Chinook differ from fall Chinook in terms of what you see, when you see them, how they act?
Well, you know, I mean, they're all connected to each other in one way or another, whether it's spring Chinook, fall Chinook, or summer steelhead. You know, the term Amayav in Kuduk language means good food, and it says that because, you know, salmon is called ama, and so there's really no better food than salmon. Now, that said, the spring salmon were most intensively managed in that principles of Kuduk harvesting law has always been that you allow for the first ones to make it to the spawning grounds to spawn and reproduce. You know, my family had a fisheries on the lower Salmon River and up in Woolly Creek. You know, there really are not very many fish, spring salmon, left in Woolly Creek, and that flows out of the Marble Mountain Wilderness. You know, it used to be the pinnacle of the run, and I was always brought up being told that those salmon in particular are different. You know, you look at them, they have more of a kind of a football shape, and they even look different than other spring salmon in other places. And so that Salmon River run is, in Kuduk tradition, is told to be a spinoff on that, which then in turn helps to supply the entire basin with spring fish. And of course, you know, there's plenty of life cycle things that Western science narrative can probably explain a little deeper than I can here today. But the fall run are a lot darker, and they come in warmer waters and, you know, softer meat and all these different things. And the summer steelhead, of course, are important in that equation, and in that we eat those up until a certain time of year when we have to stop eating those and then start eating salmon. So it kind of is as a food source, it fills the void to where you always have either lamprey or steelhead or salmon, some sort of aquatic fats in your diet, Patty.
Yeah, that's assuming fish that we've got enough fish diet to eat, of course, but yeah.
It's pretty scarce these days.
Yeah. So Sam, why don't you pick it up from there and talk a little bit about what, as Bill put, the Western sort of science frame would see. He raised the issue of the dark sort of look of a fall Chinook or a winter steelhead versus, you know, the bright look of summer steelhead and spring Chinook. But what's that mean for the fish themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with Bill. Like, I spent a number of years monitoring, doing spawning surveys for winter steelhead and then doing dive surveys for summer steelhead. And it's very clear to me that I was looking at and interacting with totally different fish. You know, these winter steelhead come up, at least in the basins around here, come up and spawn relatively quickly and return to the ocean or die. And summer steelhead, they're coming up in, you know, late spring through early summer, and we're swimming and counting them in August, and they're still hanging out in these deep pools until fall, winter, even early spring, and then going and spawning. And it was always clear to me that they were different, and I'd heard that the genetic research that had been done in the past couldn't find any difference, so it didn't seem that important. So because it's so clear, you're looking at fish, and they're not colored at all. They're dark in the summertime. They have, you know, almost no sexual characteristics for most of the summer. You really can't distinguish between the males and the females. Some individuals are very large and you assume those are males, but can't really see any sort of kipe or red cheeks or hardly any color at all.
Getting to sort of what I was hoping to elicit, which is when I read the phrase premature migration and premature migrants, I thought that the scientists meant that these were fish coming up before the rest of the migrants. But what they actually meant was that they're coming up before they're mature, before they're ready to reproduce.
Right, before they're sexually mature.
Right.
Yeah.
So the kipe is that hooked jaw that we see in mature salmon when they're back in fresh water, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess just to follow up on the story you were telling, now we do have some really different scientific information in terms of the genetics on both the spring Chinook and the summer steelhead. And what does that say?
Yeah, so initially, you know, a number of different studies were done throughout the last few decades looking at individuals' summer run and winter run steelhead and then spring and fall run Chinook in different basins. And what they found was that on like a compared a summer steelhead in the eel was more closely related to a winter steelhead in the eel than it was to a summer steelhead in the New River or the North Fork Trinity or Woolly Creek. And so based on that, this like genome-wide analysis they were doing, they decided that there was no real distinct genetic difference between the two runs. And so they were going to continue just grouping them all as steelhead. I mean, it's been developing for a number of years, but a few years ago, some research was revealed that showed at one particular region of the genome that's come to be called Greb1L, that the summer run individuals from the eel and the Trinity and the Klamath group out separately from the winter run individuals. And so they have these markers there. And so to be a summer run steelhead, you have to get two copies of the summer run allele at this particular region, one from each of your parents.
And the same thing for spring Chinook.
Yeah, the same thing for spring Chinook. And it is actually at the same region of the genome. So the idea that there was no genetic difference between the runs has kind of been disproven. And so this was potentially, you know, an additional piece of evidence that Western science said was needed to, you know, prove what a lot of people and Native people have been saying since before anyone can remember, really.
Right. So as Craig mentioned, the Karuk tribe has petitioned to list Klamath Spring Chinook. As I haven't mentioned yet, Friends of the Eel has petitioned to list Northern California Summer Steelhead under both the federal and the California Endangered Species Acts. And as I get it, it feels like the argument, if I could try to boil it down, is kind of whether that one big genetic difference that you're talking about, Sam, at the Grub1L site that says whether you're a summer steelhead or a spring Chinook is the kind of genetic difference that makes a, that really matters in terms of defining the fish we care about. I guess I want to think a little bit about why summer steelhead and spring Chinook are important in the terms of the Endangered Species Act, why they matter to ecosystems. I think Bill's made a really powerful point about how all these different runs fit in terms of the nutritional needs and the cultural reality of the people who've co-evolved with them. But in trying to list these fish, are we doing what the Endangered Species Act is supposed to do? Open question, Denny.
I'll dive in and say yes. The salmon are kind of interesting and really different than other animals when it comes to the Endangered Species Act. You know, these legal constructs of how you define a species, that's really lawyers kind of debating how to label things. And salmon is even more complicated because not only can you be listed as a species, you can be listed if you are part of an evolutionarily significant unit. And what the heck does that mean? Well, it's very clear what it means because it's been legally defined. And according to the policy, the National Marine Fisheries Service, who wrote this policy for the purpose of deciding how and when to list salmonids as endangered, policy provides that a population of Pacific salmonids is considered to be an ESU, an evolutionarily significant unit, and therefore considered for listing under the ESA if it meets the following two criteria. Number one, it must be substantially reproductively isolated from other non-specific population units. I think we just heard Bill talk about places like Woolly Creek that are exclusively populated by spring run Chinook. Number two, it must represent an important component in the evolutionary legacy of the species. Isolation does not have to be absolute, but strong enough to permit evolutionarily important differences to accrue in different population units. And so if you think about salmon trying to survive through geologic time, I guess, in these watersheds, places like the Klamath are really dynamic. We have giant volcanic eruptions. We have giant rock slides. We have enormous floods. We have droughts. And so for fish to really survive over time, they need to use all the parts of the watershed. And so having some fish come back premature in the spring, well, what's going on in the spring? The snow's melting. There's a lot of water. Well, fish can actually swim to places and get across barriers in the spring that you just can't get across in the fall when the water's low. So what this really did is allowed salmon the opportunity to take full advantage of the geographic diversity of the Klamath Basin in watersheds like the Klamath. So typically, springers go further up in the system than other fish. And this is why we see all over the Pacific Rim, spring chinook are some of the most endangered populations, because historically, these were the fish that went to the headwaters that are now blocked by dams. So having some portion of your population have this spring run gene and access these things really just sets these fish up to survive the kinds of challenges that Mother Nature and changes to geology and volcanic eruptions and all that throw at them over the course of history.
Welcome to the Eco News Report. We're talking about summer steelhead and spring chinook salmon.
That's an excellent summary, I think, of endangered species law for salmon. As a lawyer, I got to throw in that when you're talking about steelhead, we're not talking about evolutionarily significant units. We're talking about distinct population segments. And the reason that NIMS, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service set up their DPS policy, as they call it, for steelhead, is that steelhead are the seagoing, the anadromous version of rainbow trout who live in freshwater. So the Fish and Wildlife Service has jurisdiction over rainbow trout, while NIMS has jurisdiction over fish that go to the ocean, and they had to figure out a way to agree on the status of these fish. I raise this because Craig's excellent point about how spring chinook are sort of the fish that go to the top of the watershed and are often found in areas that are now behind dams applies, as the saying goes, in spades to summer steelhead and the eel. Sam, tell us what you found in rainbows above Scott Dam.
Yeah, a few years ago, we went out to the upper main stem of the eel above Scott Dam in Lake Pillsbury and did a bunch of sampling, took caudal fin samples, the tail fin samples of fish spread throughout about 10 different tributaries on both the Rice Fork, which is a major tributary to the upper eel, and then smaller creeks coming into the main stem.
Phenotype: Cold Creek, Smokehouse Creek, Salmon Creek, yeah.
Well, Cold Creek, Trout Creek, right. Horse Creek,
yeah.
Then Rice Creek, Bear Creek, Blue Slides Creek, and Rattlesnake Creek. Yeah, and we genotyped all those samples at this Grub 1L region, which distinguishes between summer and winter run steelhead. And we found, you know, relatively high frequency of both summer run and heterozygotes in a few of those tributaries, Cold Creek, Rattlesnake Creek, and Trout Creek, which are all in the upper main stem of the eel. And we found just a couple heterozygotes on the Rice Fork. And this seems, if we were to imagine where we might have seen summer steelhead historically before the dam went in, these are the locations where we probably would have imagined seeing them, because there's much higher gradient stream. There's some small barrier in there that could have acted as a seasonal barrier between the winter and summer run fish. It would have been potentially easier to get up through spring flows. And then also there's deeper pools and much colder water throughout the summertime coming off of Snow Mountain and Hole Mountain, which drain into the upper eel, compared to the Rice Fork, which is much lower gradient and intermittent in the summertime.
So the National Marine Fisheries Service has said that essentially 99% of the upper eel summer steelhead run is behind Scott Dam. But your results make me pretty hopeful that if we can get Scott Dam removed in the relatively near future, that the fish that belong there can come back. Is that realistic?
Yeah, it's been shown in other basins, like in the Elwha in Washington, for example, just that when a dam is removed, fish come back pretty quickly. And summer steelhead in particular came back very quickly to the Elwha in much higher numbers. And so those summer run alleles are still in the resident trout population. And so when anadromous steelhead were able to get up in there and can spawn with the resident trout over just a few generations, we could expect to see summer run steelhead getting back up there. It's just really neat that you can find historical evidence of a population like that in fish that have been isolated from sea run fish for just about 100 years now.
I just want to say how amazing what Sam found is. And I just want people to really digest what she's saying. And it's like, if you're not excited about salmon and steelhead, you just don't know enough about them. What she's telling us is these fish got trapped behind dams and had the phenotypic plasticity, meaning they could just change their lifestyle to no longer go back and forth from the ocean to the river and just set up shop as resident freshwater fish for generations, waiting for us to get our act together to take out dams so they can start their migration again. So the fact that they have that ability all in their DNA to live their entire lives in freshwater or as a migratory fish, it's just really amazing what these fish can do and are capable of.
Yeah, but that similar finding those alleles being maintained in populations hasn't been the case in Scott River and the Shasta River in Chinook.
Yeah, and so what she's talking about, when we talk about alleles, that sort of geneticists speak for, you know, a unit of genetic information that contains some information, right? So folks will remember that you have two copies of every gene, and each one of those copies can be exactly the same or a little bit different. So, you know, a fish could have two copies of the spring run gene, and that fish comes back early or premature. You could have two copies of the fall run gene, or in the case of steelhead, the winter run gene. In that case, you come back late in the year, sexually mature. But you can't have one copy of each. And those fish tend to come back kind of in the middle. And if you think about it, it's really an elaborate three-way biological switch. So you could have fish coming back in the spring, somewhere in, but maybe in the summer, or coming back in the fall. And it kind of gives you this variability so that depending on a given year's hydrologic conditions or weather, you have fish making the attempt to return home to spawn at different months of the year. So you would sort of, it's an insurance policy that some fish will make it.
Right. With the caveat that in nearly all years, summer is a terrible time to be in our rivers if you're a salmon or steelhead that doesn't already have a cold place to hang out. So,
and I would just add that we further screwed that up with the way we manage our hatcheries.
Right.
Because our hatcheries almost exclusively manage for fall run fish. And so what we're doing is we're just flooding the system with fall run genetic material. And what we're seeing is the spring run genetic material disappear over time. So fixing this problem is one part habitat access, which I call dam removal, but it's also going to be a change in how we run and manage our hatcheries.
Yeah, now that you bring up the point of human interaction with species and how they impact these things, I'd also like to add a point on some of the traditional harvest management practices of the Karuk people, specifically in my family's fishery up at the Schutz Woolley at Dead Horse Creek. Back in the 1920s, the state fish management agencies identified this bedrock sheet up there where we used to harvest fish. Was the only place we would harvest fish in Woolley Creek. They identified it as a fish passage barrier. And so they blasted it and manipulated it and did all these things. And so, but that fishery was used in a specific way for thousands of years. Enough time for genetic implications to occur, no doubt. And so one of the basic principles, this being a spear fishery as opposed to a weir or a dipnet fishery or other kinds of practices in other places, it was strictly off limits to spear a fish while it was trying to go up. It was only allowed to spear a fish that couldn't make it. And so you're automatically weeding out the weaker fish and allowing the ones that actually are the strongest to get above there and breed. And so, you know, when the water's lower, it becomes access limited. And so the first fish that get up there, combined with that, you know, that harvest practice, would over that type of time scale enhance a stronger species of fish to begin with.
Bill, I'm wondering if you have anything to add in terms of what it would mean for Karuk people to have enough spring Chinook back that you could be catching them in significant numbers again.
Oh, it would mean everything to not only the Karuk people, but all of the indigenous people and in the Klamath Basin and probably many, many more. It's hard to imagine surviving here without a grocery store, without having access to all the salmon and acorns you can possibly get. and we simply don't have that right now. Contemporary management practices kind of are the opposite of what we once did in this place, and the impacts are detrimental both to people and to both to the spring salmon and to the ability of people to have access to an abundance of healthy food. So food security is a major focus of what we do, you know, along with putting fire back into the landscape and tying all these pieces back together around dam removal and trying to nudge fisheries management practices in a different direction as well. You know, places like the mouth of the Salmon River were never supposed to be fished. And so now you see people down there lined up as soon as there's fish there. You know, we have a place called Cutamine and a place called Utamine. And so that's basically upper and the lower fishing places. And so our ceremonies revolved all around these harvest management practices. And all of that information is still there, and it's still alive in the hearts and minds of people today. But as long as everyone's out there mucking up the world and doing things opposite how they're supposed to be done, they become meaningless through time. And so continuing on our current trajectory and letting these species die off is also killing our culture.
Right. Yeah, I think the only other thing I was going to mention is, you know, really what the numbers have been lately, which is really bad. As you noted, Bill, you know, the path we're on does look like we're trending to extinction. Just to underscore that, you know, the numbers we see on the eel. Sam, why don't you talk about that?
Yeah. So on the eel, there's two populations that are still really in existence, extant populations, one on the Middle Fork eel and one on the Van Dusen. And the Middle Fork population has been monitored pretty consistently since the late 1960s, with an average of about 750 individuals during that time. But the last 4 or 5 years have all been below 400 individuals on the Middle Fork. And then the Van Dusen was, you know, comprehensively surveyed 5 times between the mid-70s and 2010, with an average of about 25 individuals. And since 2010, it's been an average of around 150. The maximum has been 255, and the minimum was 49. So these are pretty low numbers, and these are, you know, the only populations left. Yeah,
well under 1,000 fish, even in good years for the region. It's challenging.
Yeah.
What about the Klamath Spring Chinook, guys? What does it look like there?
In 2019, we actually count these fish by hand in the Salmon River. The Salmon River is one of the last places in the Klamath watershed where these fish can access the kind of cold water habitat they need. So it's one of the last strongholds for these fish. Folks actually snorkel the river, usually in August, and count these fish by hand. In 2019, we counted 161 spring Chinook salmon, which ain't many.
Nope.
But before everybody gets too bummed out, there is an opportunity. We do have a dam removal proposal in the Klamath River that's sitting on the desk of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for approval. And we see removing these dams as a critical part of bringing these fish back. The work that Bill and others have done to put fire back on the landscape. Fire plays a big role in these fish. The smoke from natural fire and the smoke from prescribed burning actually shades the river at critical times of year, makes the water colder, makes the fish survive. Similarly, over in the eel, there is a proposal to remove Scott Dam on the eel that just got presented to FERC by a host of parties, including Humboldt County, Mendocino County, Sonoma Water, Caltrout, and the Round Valley Tribe. So people are stepping up to the plate to do the kind of large-scale restoration, fix-the-world projects that will be necessary if we want to see these fish survive into the future.
Great. Thank you all so much.
Yeah, thank you, Sam Kenry, Bill Tripp, and Craig Tucker for joining us on the Eco News Report. This has been another issue of the Eco News Report. Join us again on this time and channel next week for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.